I sort of feel like by osmosis, I had this DNA of stones and metals in my blood.
Hello, I'm Jessica Cadso-Collins, and this is the Inside the Jewel Vault podcast. Each episode, I ask my guests to choose the six gems or jewels they would put into their fantasy jewel vault. I hope you enjoy listening. This episode of Inside the Jewel Vault was recorded remotely. I am delighted to welcome Carol Woolton to the Jewel Vault. Carol invented the concept of the jewellery editor, inaugurating the position at Tatler magazine before moving to Vogue, where her hugely impressive tenure has spanned 20 years and encompassed some of the most exciting changes in global jewellery design. She's contributed widely to magazines, newspapers and online supplements around the world, including the Financial Times, Vanity Fair, American Vogue and the Daily Telegraph. And she's the author of 5 books and also has a podcast of her own, If Jewellery Could Talk. Welcome, Carol. I can't wait to see what you've got for us inside the Jewel Vault.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Carol, I know you've taken care to choose pieces for your vault that take us through what you've written about so well in your books and journalism about what jewellery means to us culturally. So I'm curious to know where this has come from. Who or what inspired your interest in jewellery originally?
I had influence probably from a very young age. My father actually specialised in diamonds and gold, and he spent a lot of time in Australia and South Africa. I spent some years in Australia with my family. And further back than that, I had a great-grandfather, a great-great-grandfather, who went out to New South Wales in Australia as a prospector in the gold rush. And he had 2 sons, my great-grandfather, Alan Davidson, who was a complete explorer, pioneer, prospector, lived in the central Australian outback for 2 years. No one heard from him prospecting. So he was really a bushman. And so I sort of feel like by osmosis, I had this DNA of stones and metals in my blood. And my great-grandfather's brother actually was also managing director of News International in Australia. He worked in Adelaide. So I had the newspaper bit,
yeah,
and the stone bit. And I kind of feel that has to have filtered down through my blood and come out in me in some way.
So that is a fantastic story. So you mentioned that you had set off on a career in journalism. So could you talk us through how that came to be?
Yes. I mean, it was really writing that I pursued. I went to the London College of Fashion, now the University of the Arts, and studied fashion journalism. That's what I wanted to do. And I did actually, I went and worked at a, after that, I worked at a news service. And then actually I got a job at Vogue as, in those days, a secretary. And then I did move on and write a beauty checklist. And so I started off kind of writing quite a bit about lifestyle beauty and decided that I wanted to specialise in jewellery. Primarily, I thought at the time that no one did that. No one was really specializing in.
So you spotted a niche for you.
So I spotted a niche and a passion, and you know, my what I thought about stones and jewelry came out, and I found for me it had so much more depth than any other subject because of, you know, the geology, the designers, the history, the culture, the people. The fact is, it linked me to, I feel, everybody around the world because we all wear jewellery in some form. And it links me around the world. It also is a cultural link. Like it links me back to my great-grandfather or to ancestors and how they lived and what was important to them. I feel that what we know about so many civilizations is what we've learnt from their jewellery is given us a guide to how they lived and what they respected, what they honoured, their relationships. Other things have rotted and decayed, but their jewellery is as fresh and full of stories and personal history as it was when it was made for them. And I find that endlessly fascinating. And it's a subject that absorbs me on a daily basis. And at the time, you know, there was nobody in Condé Nast specializing in jewelry. And I persuaded, I'd been a contributing editor at Tatler for some time, and I persuaded the then editor, Jane Proctor, to make me their jewelry editor.
And how did you go about persuading Jane Proctor that you should be the jewelry editor?
Well, I did it with, you know, she laughs about it. I did it with quite a commercial hat on and said, you know, here are stories for a year. This is what I think I can do. This is what I feel would be beneficial for the magazine in terms of revenue. And, you know, this is what I'd like to do. And she said, oh, okay. I think that's a great idea. And off I went. And then I essentially did the same to Alex Shulman at Vogue, and I pursued that and kept sending Alex pieces of my work and saying that this is, I would love to work for Vogue. So I then went to Vogue. And, you know, at the time, American Vogue had accessories, but nobody doing fine jewelry. So I've also worked for American Vogue. I've worked for Vogue China. And my work's been translated in different Vogues around the world. And I think pretty much as soon as Alex Shulman took me onto Vogue, most magazines took a jewelry editor.
Amazing.
So do you feel that jewelry tells a story of our times just as meaningfully as fashion does?
Yes, and I think it does. I wrote the book Vogue the Jewelry some years ago and said that when I look through the archives of Vogue, I thought that jewellery told the story of dress every bit as powerfully as fashion. Because although we don't think of it, or we don't want to think of jewellery in terms of just being subject to fashion, it does tell that history of how we lived and how we dressed. So I think looking through the archives, I found that was very strongly that it did tell us the story of dress.
Yes, and also social mores, you know, the sort of cultural standards that we try to aspire to.
Yes, endless quotes in sort of in the 30s saying it was scarcely respectable to wear your duns at lunchtime. And everybody knew that. I mean, just marvellous quotes about things now that we've turned on their head, because obviously each generation wants to kick against the one before and make their own rules about how they wear their jewellery and what's important to them.
So can you tell me, Carol, what's more important to you, the clothes you're going to put on that day or the jewellery?
Well, I dress really according to what jewellery I'm going to wear that day. And that doesn't mean that I wear huge amounts of jewellery. Anyone who knows me knows it's earrings and rings are my thing.
Fascinating. So you've chosen six fantastical pieces for your own fantasy vault here. What was your criteria for choosing them?
I think a great piece of jewellery is that too. It's a decorative object that just gives you pleasure. Mm-hmm. But I want to thank you, first of all, for asking me on and making me think about this. And I know you very kindly asked me when you very first started. And it's taken me some time because I literally found this almost impossible to make a choice. Over the years, I've seen so much, as you can imagine, the historic pieces, the Catherine the Great's diamonds, the newly discovered biggest 3,000 carat diamonds discovered and shown to me at Graff, whether it's a jewel with the cloth with Charles I's blood stained on it that's been put underneath a diamond casing, Napoleon's bee that fastened his cloak together before he went into battle that I've tried on. So the modern pieces, the little golden door of a Theo Fennell ring that opens up into a secret garden vista of gemstones and enamels that he's drawn, or a pair of sort of Aztec deco fringed earrings that I commissioned Sean Lean to make. I mean, it could be any one of those. I also love the way modern techniques and modern technology is pushing jewellery. And the Nature Triumphant ring that I tried on a couple of years ago at Boucheron, that they'd scanned real petals of flowers and stabilised them, set them on platinum and set with a gemstone. So it actually is a flower. It's a flower that will be eternal. So it could be anything by James de Givenchy or the Michel Ong's rose cut diamond pieces. I mean, any of those on any given day. But you made me fine it down and think about it.
Well, gosh. So can we talk about the first piece then?
Yes. So the first piece is a miniature, early 19th century, of an eye.
Very enigmatic piece.
It's very enigmatic. Obviously, it's anonymous. These things were executed in watercolour and later enamel, painted on ivory. Tiny portable portraits. And you could keep it as a stand-in for the real person when you were parted or worn next to your heart. And indeed, King George the Fourth was buried with a miniature of Maria Fitzherbert, his mistress, with whom he went through a secret marriage ceremony. And it was buried with him on his heart, where he said he used to keep it when he was alive. And I love this piece because it is interesting on so many levels. You look at it, it's anonymous, it's mysterious, it has a piercing gaze, and you feel a connection to the subject, although you've never met her. And her story is long forgotten, but you have the feeling you know her, and it makes you imagine who she was, who she loved, and what her story was. And as there's a little trompe d'oeil tear, I imagine it's a sad story. They're parted. The love affair has stalled for some reason. So it's very elegant. It's got that Georgian elegance about it. A beautiful jewelled object. And I think also, it's got the eye, which is the window to the soul. The artist is trying to show reflecting this person's intimate, innermost thoughts. And the eye is one of the most powerful symbols used by man, symbol of watchfulness and intimacy, and used in dozens of different cultures as a protective symbol.
Yes, yeah.
And also, it has this element for me that it is a type of jewel that was influential in shaping the visual culture of the time. So these sort of portraits in little have, they shine a light on the customs and behaviour and way of life at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because as we saw recently, if anyone watched the Netflix show Bridgerton, yes. Socialising was a very intense pursuit for the Georgians. So the act of looking was very important in this strata of society. And at the time, people were infatuated in seeing and being seen. There were new pleasure gardens set up. There were masquerade balls and dances every night.
Of course, yes.
And the social codes meant that people between the opposite sex of particularly vulnerable ages couldn't necessarily spend time together or exchange words, but looks could be exchanged easily. So it speaks of an intense moment in history and encapsulates an era as well as a fashion.
Yes, it's multi-layered. It really is. And I hadn't considered it until you described the numerous layers. Where is this particular piece?
This is at the V&A. Ah. It's on display at the V&A, anonymous. It's also of its era in the way that obviously by the end of that century, nobody was doing that anymore or carrying these pieces because photography had struck a death blow to the miniature. Mm-hmm. And I find that very interesting too, because in a way, this was what the Georgians did, and now we have our selfies.
Yes.
People swap selfies. They might swap different body parts as well. Not their elegant body parts in their selfie. So I like to sort of compare it to then and now, and that this is a sort of a human way of being, that we want to carry our loved ones or pictures of our loved ones around with us. I think also, if we think of George IV and Mrs. Fitzherbert, I think he had about 11 of these painted of himself and her to give and receive. And often they were at moments of heightened emotions in tumultuous relationships. You know, it was like, please don't give up on me, or please come and see me, or we can get together, we will be together in the end. I think, you know, they had all this sort of messaging going on secretly that we obviously don't know about.
Lovely. And so on to the second piece in your vault.
The second piece is around 1900, and it's a piece by Peter Carl Fabergé, the great Russian goldsmith and designer and enameller. And I've seen a lot of works by Fabergé, extraordinarily carved stone animals, his enameling work, which was copied by everybody. He had, you know, hundreds of different colours that, and a particular way of layering the enamel, and beautiful pieces using Siberian sapphires, beautifully cut chunks of aquamarine or amethyst set with diamonds. But for me, his flower studies are his most exquisite objects. And I think the reason is that it's an extraordinary feat of craftsmanship to capture something so fleeting and delicate, like a dandelion head or a ripening strawberry, and not lose any sense of its delicacy whilst using unyielding the hardest materials known to man. And I find that aspect very magical, and I find the subject he's used very compelling.
And this is a rock crystal vase containing a tiny spray of delicate lily of the valley.
That's right. It's very interesting that rock crystal was named ice, crystallos, by the ancient Greeks because it felt cold to the touch, but had the appearance of water. So it really to them was frozen water. And I think here he's demonstrated it perfectly, simulating the curved surface of water lying inside a vase.
Yes.
So it's absolutely beautiful. And I think the natural beauty of the flowers appealed to Fabergé, which is why it's so realistic. And that for the most part, his pieces really were botanically quite accurate as well. Mm-hmm. And they had stunning naturalism for his wealthy Russian clients. And you can imagine, they were living in these long, long, harsh winters. And so homegrown flowers would be seen very briefly. So these studies, decorative floral jewels, acted as a reminder that spring would eventually come around again.
Yes, of course. Oh, yes, I love the way you've described that. That's beautiful. Thank you, Carol. So you'd have that in your vault, and I can see why. So you've got
If I could, I'd have them dotted around my house, actually. Instead of fresh flowers, I'd have them dotted everywhere.
So long as nobody knocked them over.
Yes. And I wouldn't have to water them.
No. Or wash the vase. So tell me, Carol, what's the third beautiful piece in your vault?
The third one's 1925, dated, and it's by Cartier. And this was made immediately following the discovery of King Tutankhamun's tomb by Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon, which was in 1923. And obviously that was the biggest news globally, and sparked a period of Egyptian everything in everything. And everyone was inspired by these ancient treasures that were unearthed in the tomb.
Yes, breathtaking. So can you describe to us what it is?
This is an ancient statuette dating from the second half of the first millennium. And it's the lion-headed goddess Sekhmet, who is an incarnation of the scorching eye of the sun. And she protected pharaohs and accompanied them during times of war. And I think, you know, everyone, interior designers, fashion designers, jewelers, everyone was imitating Egyptian influences and patterns using hieroglyphics and the sacred scarabs and gods. But this Cartier one is on another level because it is created with this ancient piece of Egyptian. They've used this ancient statuette. And Cartier set it with diamonds and sapphires in the fresh modern Art Deco style at the time, at which they were at the forefront.
So is it a brooch?
It's a brooch. And it's a stylized lotus blossom. There's a diamond set bracelet, little armband, golden belts, and the sun disc above, decorated with rubies and emeralds, black enamel and diamonds. And so what I find very stunning about this piece is that it unites two great art movements, which is the Egyptian Revival movement and Art Deco. And I think the Art Deco movement, as we know, cast aside traditions of the past to create jewels that were sleek and bold, using geometric shapes and unorthodox combinations of stones. And I think this, to me, combines all of that. It's got this extraordinary combination of ancient with entirely modern new designs with ancient artwork. So I think it's got so much, and very visually arresting in a way that you wouldn't imagine that would all work together.
How would you wear it?
I would probably wear it. I'd wear it sort of high on a belt, I think, or just literally keeping together a blouse quite low, but just on its own and just somewhere very prominent so people could see it and also so I could see it too.
We're at piece number four now, which is beautiful. Are you going to tell us about this, please?
Yeah, this is sort of 1930, and it's a ring. And it's a ring in gold and platinum with a diamond set in the middle. It's Art Modern. And I've had experts look at it, and they think it's Raymond Templier.
It's yours.
And it's mine.
And Carol, so it's a personal treasure.
It's a personal treasure, but really encapsulates an era and an art movement that I'm really drawn to. It never fails to excite me when I look at this ring. And it, again, what I think is interesting about my choice of it is it's like, in a way, the Georgian brooch at the beginning, although the styles are so different, creatively, they were both made and inspired by moments of turbulent change. I think social and economic change can sometimes provoke really interesting art and creation. And this, in the Georgian period, you had the Industrial Revolution kicking off. And so that was affecting everybody's daily life and how they lived. And at this moment, again, it was technology that inspired modernist principles with an emphasis on structure and technology and the new forms of the machine age. And they were geometric lines, circles, curved arcs, as you can see in this ring, almost like cogs and wheels. And that was all come about from this moment of, you know, aeroplanes and cars and this sort of modern age of the machine.
And it looks like it should feel quite hefty, comfortably hefty.
Yes, it is. It's comfortably hefty. And I went to, many years ago, an exhibition on Art Modern at the Musée des Arts Décoratifs in Paris. And I saw a lot of work of Raymond Templier and Jean Dupré. Jean Dupré actually worked on the industrial design of aeroplanes during the war. And that's very evident in his industrial look and the industrial look of Templier. But the jewels they created, although modern, were also graceful and refined. And I think that's quite an art to be able to combine those. And they really set about, formed a group together of the union of modern artists, and they were looked for a fresh direction, and they wanted to move away from the past, Raymond Templier was like a third or fourth generation jeweler, but he wanted to move away from the past that he had grown up in and create this new look. And he said, I find inspiration as he walks the streets from the wheels, the cars, and the machinery of today. And seeing these pieces in Paris made me determined to find one.
Wow. So thank you for choosing that and sharing it with us. How often do you think you wear that? Is that something
I wear all the time. And in fact, in the Vogue office, I was always wearing it. And quite a lot of young designers, like particularly Dominic Jones, was inspired to create a collection around Carol's ring.
So it has its own fan base.
And then, so I did wear it relentlessly for years and now it comes and goes, but it's always there. And every time, as I say, I look at it, it looks very, very new to me and new and exciting.
That's four fabulous pieces. What is piece number five?
Piece number five is not something you'd wear. It is, for the love of God, a skull. Created in 2007 by the artist Damien Hirst.
Yes, a very astonishing piece. And actually, it had its own art gallery when it was first displayed, didn't it?
It did. And I think that's the thing. You really had to see it. And there was a lot of hype, a lot of publicity surrounding it. And people were debating whether or not this was crass at the time, that it was about money because the, 9,000 diamonds in it and this big, big center pink diamond in the forehead of the skull. And a lot of people discussing it, but I have chosen each piece on the visceral effect it had on me physically when I saw these pieces. And this, as you know, was displayed at the White Cube Gallery in a blackened room with a light shining on it. And when you walked in there, you were just blown away by it. It had such an impact. And I think it's like a lot of things. You could see a million photographs of the Mona Lisa or see a million photographs of the Grand Canal in Venice and feel like you've seen it. But until you're there and see it in reality for yourself, you don't get that impact. And it really had that. And again, there's so many layers to make you think it's the effigy of death used so often in art, the skull. And it was in a black room on a black pedestal. But as I said, light bouncing off these thousands of tiny diamonds around the room with this one large pear-shaped pink mounted in the forehead, almost like a third eye or crown chakra, which gave it a sort of divine feeling. Or divine aura bouncing around with this light. And I think often skulls are very sort of ghostly or dark and menacing. But this one, with the light and the diamonds, sort of almost seem alive and rather magnificent. And although it carries that message of the brevity of life and vanity of the human, as Damien has said, he felt it was very hopeful. It was a very hopeful piece. And I think that the skull, fragility of the skull, and the message of dust to dust, ashes to ashes, has been made eternal by being recreated in platinum. And the diamonds that we know have a life beyond our own, which are eternal, it has this sort of play on our own, that brevity of life and the eternal life of the jewel. And plus it was a technical feat. There are 32 platinum plates that were made from its cast. It's hand lasered with these thousands of tiny holes. So the diamonds were individually set like a sort of honeycomb effect. It was bold. Obviously we know Damien Hirst is very bold. To create it was the most expensive jewellery commission since the crown jewels. And I just loved, as I say, this fragile, decayed skull combined with ancient carbon from the earth, merging it into something, again, with this very modern, powerful appeal. Yeah. I mean, it really was compelling. And he said at the time, It's the maximum I can throw against death.
So the sixth and final piece, Carol, what have you put in your vault here?
The sixth piece was created in 1991 by Joel Arthur Rosenthal, who's the great name of our period. And it is an oriental pearl. It's diamonds and gold and platinum, and it is a lily of the valley as well. It's kind of coincidence that I've chosen two lily of the valley pieces, because on the whole, I really like hydrangeas, but I like these jeweled lilies of the valleys. And this was exhibited at the Metropolitan Museum in 2014. They did a big show, a retrospective of the work of Joel Rosenthal, and he was the only living artist to be exhibited at the Met in a show like that. And that really speaks about his importance as the most acclaimed name of the 20th century in jewellery. He works in Paris. He's an American in Paris. He was born in New York, educated at Harvard, and moved to Paris shortly after his graduation. He worked very briefly for Bulgari, but essentially started in jewellery making on his own. And he opened in 1978 on the Place Vendôme, and he's been there ever since. Very quiet. He is fiercely protective of his work and his atelier, and is known for his incredible sense of colour, even though I've chosen a piece with very little colour, which is really essentially white. But like with Fabergé, for me, it's his flower studies that I find so arresting. This piece actually appeared in my book, Floral Jewels, and Joel Rosenthal very kindly wrote the foreword for me for that book. And I described in the book how he works surrounded by botanical journals, gardening journals, horticultural magazines. And there's always a vase, tall stem flowers on his desk. You get the feeling that flowers are all around him, and he visualises them very quickly, but executes them quite slowly and works to their realism.
So this is a beautiful piece. It's a brooch, isn't it?
It's another brooch, yes.
It is an astonishing contrast to depict something so fresh, fleeting and fragile as a spray of Lily of the Valley, right after Damien Hirst's mockery of our hubris, isn't it?
But this gives me hope, you see, too. But Damien Hirst created that as he saw it, to give people hope. And this gives me tremendous hope. I think the Lily of the Valley, by its nature, it's just delicate sprigs that shoot up in spring through the frozen earth. You know, they have this great strength, even though they look so delicate. And it makes you think of rebirth, and they're known for return to happiness. And I think there's something about it that's very heart-stopping. And when I saw it at the Met, it just had this great emotional reaction inside me.
Oh, wonderful. So it really spoke to you.
I don't know if it was the nature of the tremulous little scalloped-edged diamond bells, the stalk loosely tied with a diamond ribble, and this large oriental pearl that just slightly modestly drops in between to one side. And it just, something about that fabrication just touched me. And he does create each flower petal by petal. Each piece is made separately. So again, it's this extraordinary feat of craftsmanship from one of his workshops. And but not even knowing that, just looking at it and that vulnerable nature of the Lily of the Valley, but underpinned by its strength, really, really touches me.
Yes, I can absolutely get that.
And the way it's just sort of loosely tied with a diamond ribbon, you just imagine that that is, somebody is gifting that. They're gifting you this lovely sprig, which is a really lovely thing to do.
It's very innocent looking, isn't it?
But it is.
And that's the joy, the beauty of Jar's pieces, is that they look effortless.
Effortless, but hugely sophisticated.
So overall, to go back to where we were at the beginning of our chat, Carol, you mentioned that to you, jewellery is a vast subject. It covers so many different parts of us, our experiences as humans.
It does. And I think writing the New Stone Age, and I try and talk about all these different subjects on my podcast, you know, the sort of cultural influence, the stones, the people, the historic use, as well as the modern and contemporary and what we're doing now. Because I think each of the pieces I've chosen pretty much was sparked by something important happening in art movements or important social economic changes that do get people thinking, and that thinking does provoke design and new design and people to sort of break rules and change things from the past. And I think that comes through in all these pieces. They're very exciting.
So this is the question that everyone has to come to. And this is you've said it was already difficult to choose six pieces. So which one piece would you keep forever out of this glorious assortment of jewels and ornaments, precious objects? Which one piece?
Well, I thought if I am on a desert island, and this is a sort of like your desert island choices, isn't it, really?
It is a bit.
And I would think that I would take the Jar brooch with me because...
Oh, yes.
A brooch does actually also have a functional aspect to it. It does attach pieces of fabric together. And I might need that. I might need that. And so it does have a practicality, even though it's just a beautiful object as well. And I think, you know, as I was talking about it, symbolising hope and happiness and spring. And I would imagine that I would be rescued from my island and returned, and it would be something very, very hopeful and a symbol of strength as well in my life. And I, you know, and if it was in my normal everyday to day life, even if I didn't wear it that much, because I wouldn't want to wear it on the tube or anything like that, I would just know I owned it. And I would look at it every day in wonder.
As a charm to your life. That's beautiful, Carol. Thank you. I can actually feel my eyes welling up. Oh, well, look, Carol, it's been such a joy to talk to you and to hear how meaningful jewellery is to you and culture in general. Has been a real treat. So thank you so much for sharing your life and career in jewellery with us through these six beautiful objects.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me and making me think about it and making me find out my choices, and as difficult as it was.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we did recording it. You can find images of all the wonderful jewels we've been talking about, along with lots more information at our website. Just go to vipjewelvault.com/podcast. And I want to hear from you. Tell me, what special pieces would you put into your fantasy jewel vault and why? Every so often I'll be collating your stories into a podcast of their own. So please get in touch, and of course rate, review and subscribe so we can keep these conversations as meaningful and joyous as we can. Thank you.